and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu, and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. Early this morning, the result for the Brecon and Radnorshire by-election came out, and the Liberal Democrats have won that seat by a margin of 1,425 votes. Katie, what does this result mean?
So the result is what was being predicted widely, which is it would be a Liberal Democrat win in a seat that they used to have quite a long reign of having an MP in. It only went to the Tories in 2015. They held on to it in 2017. So I think this is the expected result. However, the margins, I think, are much closer than lots were expecting. So there was some talk of a Lib Dem landslide. Now, they have managed to overturn a sizeable majority, but ultimately it's a margin of 1,425 votes. That means that this is going to be a target seat for the Tories whenever the next election comes. Now, given that technically it's a working majority of one, that election could come sooner rather than later. But I think Conservatives are, I wouldn't say pleasantly surprised, because I think pleasantly surprised makes them suggest that, that was an okay result, because ultimately what's happened here is, if you look at the build-up to this by-election, it seemed as though the Tories were really following a guide on how to lose a by-election. The reason we have a by-election is because Chris Davies, the then incumbent MP, was found guilty of expenses fraud. There was a recall petition by local residents who didn't want him to stay, sparked a by-election, and then the Conservative response was to put the same MP, Chris Davies, back as their candidate, who had just been rejected, and try and win it. So I think, therefore, it's tricky to read too much into what this means about the Tories' Brexit position, because ultimately it's a small margin, and we know that local residents are very unhappy with the candidate. That said, I think you're seeing some of the same patterns that we've seen in recent by-elections, so Peterborough, which is, if you look at that Brexit Party vote now, the Brexit Party got 3,331 votes. That is not the type of vote share you would expect of a party that's about to smash the two-party system, as Nigel Farage has said he hopes for his party. I don't think it gives the impression that they are a serious electoral force yet, but it does show that the Brexit Party can effectively eat into the Tory vote share. And you put that against what's happened on the Lib Dems, because the Lib Dems are part of a Remain alliance in this area. So Plaid Cymru and the Greens both didn't stand candidates. Now, if less than half of the Brexit Party voters had gone for the Tories, they would have held on to the seat, the Conservative Party. So I think it is a reminder of the damage the Brexit Party can do to the Tories, even if the Brexit Party itself does not win. So while the Remain parties might be able to think about this alliance, which I think we'll see more of, I don't yet get the impression that Nigel Farage wants to help Boris Johnson to win a majority at the next election. Although I think that if you look at the level of Leave votes, it would make sense to have a common aim and have one candidate for leaving. I don't think that Nigel Farage's top priority is helping the Tory party to survive.
James, Jo Swinson today has come out to say that this is a huge success for the Remain alliance, evidence to show that if the Remain parties come together, they can win the next election as well. Do you think that's fair?
I think it is important for this Remain alliance, because it is, if the Lib Dems had won big, some people would have said, oh, they'd have won regardless of whether they'd done this pact or not. But their margin, the narrow margin of victory, suggests that it was the pact what did it for them. Now, obviously, the challenge with pacts is, you know, where do you find places where, you've got to find places where the other parties involved in the pact, so the Greens and Plaid Cymru, would benefit from this pact. Otherwise, if it is all to the Lib Dems' benefit, it is harder to see how you keep those other parties on board with it. But I think, as Katie said, I mean, this result was actually not as bad for the Tories as people might have expected, I think, given the unique circumstances of the by-election. Indeed, when you look at it, you do wonder, you know, forget about the Brexit Party for a second, you do wonder how different things might have been with a clean-skinned Tory candidate, and if Boris Johnson had been Prime Minister when the postal votes went out. And there's a kind of, there is a sense that the postal votes were worse for the Tories than the on-the-day voting. And I think it does suggest that he is at least having some success in squeezing down that Brexit Party vote. But as Katie said, even if that Brexit Party vote is squeezed down, it's still going to be problematic for the Tories. I thought one other thing that jumped out at me from the result was, when you look at the numbers, you know, if you were looking at the kind of seat that might take fright at the idea, that voted for Brexit, that might take fright at the idea of no deal Brexit, this seat would be relatively high on your list, because it's got a kind of heavy agricultural base, and undoubtedly farming would be hit in particular by a no-deal Brexit. And I think it is striking how if you do that crude thing of adding up the Tory party vote with the Brexit party vote and then adding up, you know, you don't actually need to add up the Remain party's votes in this election because they all stood in an alliance. Even if you add Labour onto that score, it shows that there's been minimal change in opinion in this seat since the referendum in 2016, which is in a way is interesting because in the run-up to this by-election, lots of people thought that this seat was going to show that, particularly in rural and agricultural communities, when they saw what a no-deal Brexit would mean for their industry, they would shy away from it. That doesn't appear to be happening in Brecon and Radnorshire, which is quite interesting. And I mean, you know, worth bearing in mind when we discuss this whole idea of a kind of what might happen in a general election fought on the issue of no deal.
And I think one of the issues here is, faced with this Remain alliance, if they can get it to work, how do the Tories counter it? Because there's several reasons why it seems unlikely that they'll be able to strike up a Brexit alliance with the Brexit party. And that includes the fact that Boris Johnson repeatedly said during the leadership campaign he wanted to put Nigel Farage back in his box. He said his big sell as a candidate was the fact that he would destroy the need for a Brexit party. Secondly, Nigel Farage has made quite clear the fact that he doesn't want to stand his party down. I think he also would like to damage the Conservative Party as well as delivering Brexit. And also third, there are lots of Conservative MPs and Conservative voters who'd be really wary about entering any sort of electoral pact with the Brexit party, because even though they are really aiming to reunite the Leave vote in a general election, they also want to try and bring back or keep hold of some of those Tory Lib Dem voters. And I think to enter a pact with Nigel Farage would be a big turn off to that section.
And James, one party that we've barely mentioned today is the Labour Party, which came fourth even after the Brexit Party's 3,000 votes. What are we to make of that?
On the one hand, not too much, in that the other party, the party that isn't a runner, always gets squeezed in a by-election. And this seat has historically been a Tory Lib Dem marginal. But I think there is a question for Labour with the election of Boris Johnson as Tory leader, which is politics is increasingly becoming about Leave Remain. You know, perhaps in some ways more than left right. Yeah. And with Boris Johnson, the Tories are now clearly identified with Leave. The Lib Dems, with their rather crude slogan, are clearly identified with Remain.
Yeah.
Labour are in a slightly more ambivalent position. And They have shifted much more in a Remain direction than before, but they haven't fully made the move. And I think there is a risk for Labour that they will end up fully making the move to Remain, but Remain voters will not trust them because of how long it took them to get there. Mm. And they'll alienate Leave voters who say, oh, well, they're not for us anymore because they're now Remainers. And I think that is the danger for Jeremy Corbyn. But you know, in the 2017 election, you know, the view of the view of the commentariat was, at the start of the campaign, was that Labour's Brexit position was they were going to stand in the middle of the road and they were going to get run over. In that campaign, they actually ended up brilliantly straddling the two positions.
And getting the youth vote for
Remainers. Yeah, they managed to get Remainers to vote for them despite a manifesto that committed to Brexit that reassured Leavers. I wonder if we end up in a general election in the next 6 months or a year or so, whether they will end up, you know, suffering the price that we thought they might pay in 2017, because they will be regarded as neither fish nor fowl.
And Katie, this week, the governor of the Bank of England has come out with another one of his Brexit warnings. He said that leaving without a deal would be an instantaneous shock to the British economy and sink the pound to a 34-year low. What do you make of that?
It was one of several forecasts, you could call them warnings, by the Bank of England, which also included there would be a 1 in 3 chance of a recession by the start of 2020. And they also revised growth forecasts in a downward pattern or direction. So it was probably quite gloomy news. I think if you're going to use Boris Johnson language, gloomster, doomster. But ultimately,
not believing in Britain.
But ultimately, I don't think anyone is dismissing the fact that these things could happen. I think what's changed, however, is you now have a government which is unashamedly pro-Brexit and ultimately has said its primary aim is to deliver Brexit by the end of October, even if that means leaving without a deal. I think when Theresa May was in charge, there was a sense that she hadn't yet made her mind up about whether or not she was willing to pursue a no-deal Brexit. Mm. So even though she kept saying no deal is better than a bad deal, once she actually saw, and there was a Mark Sedwell memo around the time when she was trying to get her cabinet to make that decision, once she saw all the things that might happen, it was clear that she wasn't willing to be the person to be responsible for that. This government is different. I don't think that any warnings or forecasts are going to put them off what they're doing. I think the basic strategy or the way of dealing is saying, well, we are leaving, let's try and mitigate some of these things. So while I think it will be worrying to some people, I don't think it changes the general flow of travel.
James, there was a really interesting report in The Guardian today that said actually if a no-deal came around in October as opposed to it would have done in March, we're actually going to be less prepared for it than in March. Can you just explain the logic of that?
I think you've got to separate two things out, the private sector response and the government response. I think in terms of the private sector, October the 31st is a trickier date than March 29th, because October the 31st is obviously closer to Christmas than March 29th, so it is harder to find warehouse space, stockpiling, etc., etc., etc. Also, if you look at the kind of UK food cycle, over the summer months, we consume more stuff that we grow and produce ourselves than we do during the winter. So that is the kind of issue there. I think the issue on the government side is I think that there is now a seriousness and intensity to the government's no deal prep that there never has been before. And I think it's worth remembering that, you know, Steve Barclay went off of one on cabinet towards the very end of the Theresa May days, basically saying, look, this is ridiculous. We got an extension and we're now less prepared for a no deal Brexit than we were in the run up to March 29th. What are we doing with this time? I think there is now a much greater emphasis on no deal planning. But, you know, undoubtedly, the government, I think, will be more prepared on October the 31st than it was on March 29th. But I think it is a more difficult time of year. I mean, that sounds slightly absurd to say it, but it is, I think, a more difficult time of year to leave the EU for March 29th. I mean, it's just a kind of, it's not a date. If you were picking the date in the year to do it, it's not when you would do it. It's also a Thursday, which again is problematic, which is March 29th, I believe, was a week, or it was either a Friday or a weekend day. And so essentially, you would have had a little bit of time to work through what was going on before you got onto the full intensity of the working week. This is going to plunge you straight into Friday. You know, I mean, the problem is that some people think there should be a bank holiday declared for November 1st, just for the simple reason of,
you know,
it would be good to reduce some of the intensity of that first day after no deal to give the government more time to see where the issues are.
And Katie, there are rumours that George Osborne might add one more thing to his CV, one more job to his lot.
Yes, the rumour mill is going into overdrive this week. We've heard about this a few times, but the idea that George Osborne is going to be Britain's candidate for the International Monetary Fund. Now, this comes after Christine Lagarde left the IMF, and ultimately it would mean that Boris Johnson would nominate him. Now, The Sun is reporting that Boris Johnson is poised to nominate George Osborne, and it would be an interesting meeting of minds in many respects, because the former Chancellor is someone who campaigned passionately for Remain in the EU referendum. He's accused of being behind many of the Project Fear warnings. He did a potential Brexit budget, which was seen as a Treasury terror chest, really. So for him to then be nominated by Boris Johnson would show there'd been a real journey in terms of opinion for both of them.
I actually think the most interesting thing about this is what this says about the future of UK-EU relations, right? So the IMF chief exec is a European. The EU at the moment is currently split on which candidates to nominate, and neither of the EU candidates are particularly impressive. I think if Theresa May was still in Downing Street, I mean, the UK would probably be saying, OK, well, we'll wait for the EU to come up with a consensus and back that candidate. I think it is quite interesting, this willingness to put forward the UK's own candidate. And as I understand the strategy, the hope is that the Americans and the Chinese might not be too impressed by the EU candidate, and therefore they might turn to George Osborne. Now, I think this is a very long shot overall, but it is an interesting sign of this administration's willingness to kind of not try and curry favour with the EU. I think the previous administration would have looked at this as an obvious chance to kind of get some credit in the bank with the EU by playing a constructive role, not throwing up any obstacles, or, you know, maybe trying to please President Macron by backing his choice rather than the more hawkish Dieselboom choice, all of that. I think it is quite interesting that the UK government does look like it is prepared to back its own candidate, and it is obviously worth remembering that George Osborne did endorse Boris Johnson in the Tory leadership contest.
What a coincidence. James and Katie, thanks very much. You can subscribe to this podcast through all the usual routes and do rate and review us. And don't forget, Douglas Murray is in conversation with Lionel Shriver this October 28th in Westminster. To get tickets, go on to spectator.co.uk/Lionel. Thanks for listening and join us again next week.